Today on ID the Future, we're happy to bring you another interview with Dr. Tom Woodward, host of the Universe Next Door syndicated radio broadcast. In conjunction with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, Dr. Woodward regularly interviews CSC scientists and scholars on various aspects of the debate over Darwinian evolution and intelligent design.
Welcome to the Universe Next Door, where today our focus is going to be on a new book that was just released from the Discovery Institute, edited by Dr. John West. He is an author, a speaker, and a researcher himself. He has been for many years a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute, and he is the co-editor of many other books and author of many other articles, but he is the chief editor and a very key contributor to a new book which really ties together the world of C.S. Lewis and the world of science. The book's name is The Magician's Twin, and the subtitle is C.S. Lewis on Science, Scientism, and Society. Dr. John West, welcome back to the Universe Next Door.
Great to be here, Tom.
Thank you so much for joining us. We are together with Bill Carr, our very able technical host. Bill, we're excited to really link together these two parts of the universe. We're talking about the universe next door. There's two universes that we're linking.
Right. Well, it was so exciting prior to getting with Dr. West on the phone here. Prior to the program today, you came in and you were just all so excited about this. And I think you told me, you said something like, you said wow out loud probably 25 times while you're reading the
in
book.
Just one chapter.
So yeah, the wow factor in one chapter is
it was
huge.
Off the chart. I mean, we have been told so many times that C.S. Lewis, if he was alive today, would be outspoken in favor of the Christian Darwinist view that we see expressed, for example, by the BioLogos website, through such authors as Francis Collins in The Language of God and other books. And we have been in need for some years for an in-depth analysis of what exactly C.S. Lewis wrote in relation to science and society, and specifically some of the ideas that had been embedded in Western culture since the 1800s about these origins issues, the origin of the universe, the origin of reason, the origin of morals. Do they have an origin through the interaction of material entities in the universe, or do they point beyond the universe to a transcendent source, specifically God? And of course, Lewis would defend the notion of the Judeo-Christian, the personal God that we find in the Bible. Dr. West, you and I have known each other for a number of years. I've sat at your feet, so to speak, in many of the lectures that you've presented out there in Seattle and elsewhere. How did you get interested in even tackling the topic of C.S. Lewis's take on science?
Well, you know, I got interested because of an article written in Christian journal Perspectives on Science and the Christian Faith by Michael Peterson, who's a theologian from Asbury Seminary. And he wrote an article basically claiming that C.S. Lewis not only would have embraced everything in sort of the Darwinian story, but that he would have been anti-intelligent design. And that article was so frustrating because, first of all, most of it actually simply was Peterson spouting his own views on intelligent design and then just assuming that those views were C.S. Lewis's views. So it really was a thinly sourced, not very well justified article. And then that article was picked up by the BioLogos Foundation, serialized in six parts. And so it got a lot of play. And so I got some emails from people knowing that previously, say, I had was co-editor of an encyclopedia about Lewis, and so they knew something about Lewis and saying, what is this? Is this true or not? And so that sort of was the initial impetus. But, you know, I have loved Lewis ever since one of my sisters gave me a copy of The Chronicles of Narnia when I was in grade school.
Wow.
And then wanted to read everything he wrote, even things I couldn't understand at the time and when I was a kid. And so I've had a lifelong love of Lewis and fascination with some of his writings about the dangers of scientism. I think one of my favorite things by Lewis is his novel, That Hideous Strength, and the accompanying book, The Abolition of Man, and the dangers of scientific materialism, which really was one of the ways I got involved in the intelligent design movement. That interest, when I first heard Steve Meyer give a talk about what ultimately became his book, The Signature in the Cell, that if you go down to the very heart of matter, you find evidence of mind. One reason I was intrigued by that is because I had been schooled by people like C.S. Lewis and G.K. Chesterton and others about the dangers of scientific materialism, the claim that modern science actually provides a justification for just outright materialism, that we're just the product of blind matter and motion. And so as a social scientist, I had always really taken Lewis's warnings about efforts, say, to re-engineer the human race and that we're just blind matter in motion, that idea, how dangerous it was, I had always taken that seriously. And that it also provided a segue to me getting involved in the design movement. So I didn't need a lot of push to get involved in this. But then when I got in deeper, it was terrific because I read and reread things that I hadn't read for a while, including since I'd been so involved in the design movement, and things I'd even forgotten about, and then found things that I didn't know about, and new notes by Lewis and some unpublished letters that no one has written about before that come out for the first time in this book. And so it was a very exciting process.
Very good. With us today on the phone, Dr. John West. He is affiliated with the Discovery Institute as senior fellow. He is formerly was a chair of the Department of Political Science and Geography at Seattle Pacific University. Holds a PhD in government from Claremont Graduate University, and he is a prolific author and lecturer. He is the editor and, you might say in a way, the co-author. He wrote a good chunk of this incredible, exciting, I'm describing it now as a bombshell book, The Magician's Twin. And again, it deals with C.S. Lewis on science, scientism, and society. Dr. West, I think you're aware of the fact that our own organization, the C.S. Lewis Society, has had great interest in intelligent design for years. So you probably can see the relevance of this book to what we're doing.
You're a trailblazer.
Well, we're trying to show that actually Lewis was a prophet. And I'm looking now at the introduction that you wrote. Of course, we have a foreword from Dr. Philip Johnson, formerly the head of the intelligent design movement, now retired a law professor from Berkeley. And in the introduction, you write, Narnia, Screwtape, Your Christianity. With more than 200 million copies of his books reportedly sold, C.S. Lewis is known and beloved by readers around the globe for his children's stories, his works of theology, and his winsome and witty defenses of Orthodox Christianity. One thing Lewis is not particularly well known for is his views on science. And then let me reveal the next sentence. I think this is a bombshell. Yet he ultimately wrote 9 books, nearly 30 essays, and several poems that explored science and its cultural impact. That alone is a really key and shocking fact. I think most people are not aware of Lewis's engaging the world of science. Would you agree?
I do agree. And even for myself, even though I knew of most of these things, when I started to add them up, I was not exactly shocked, but it made quite an impression. And you know what also made an impression, which is also new in this book, of when I found the list of Lewis's personal library, and not all of which have been preserved, but many of the copies of which are now at the Wade Center Collection at Wheaton College. Mm-hmm. In his own personal library, he had more than 36 books and pamphlets focusing on science, and many of which dealing with evolution in particular, and a number of which are marked up heavily with annotations and underlining. And so that really, to me, drove home not the, the interest that came out in his writings, but you can also see it in his personal library.
Very good. Today we're featuring this important new book. It is available on our website, The Magician's Twin. The book is actually published by Discovery Institute. And so for more information, of course, you can always access their own website, discovery.org/CSC, which stands for the Center for Science and Culture. Dr. John West is a contributor to this volume. And I notice you have some other of your, I believe, Discovery Institute colleagues involved in various chapters and essays. Is that correct?
We do. Jay Richards, obviously many of your listeners will know him from The Privileged Planet and his other books. Jack Collins from Covenant Seminary has a great chapter. He actually teaches about Lewis at his seminary. And then a cast of new people who actually aren't from Discovery Institute.
Sure.
And including Michael Eshelman, Victor Reppert, author of probably the best book about Lewis's Argument for Reason, C.S. Lewis's Dangerous Idea. So
very good. It's a star-studded cast, if I can say that in a kind of a summary statement here. Today we're featuring, again, the book The Magician's Twin, a book focused on the connection between C.S. Lewis's analysis of the modern worldviews and the area of science and society. Very important book. We'll be right back with the editor and co-author of this book, Dr. John West, after a quick break on The Universe Next Door. Welcome back to The Universe Next Door, where we are touring a very important part of the universe, the science side of it, and with the help of a number of very gifted scholars who have banded together and produced a masterful book called The Magician's Twin. And this book explores the mind and the insights of C.S. Lewis through many of his writings, probably 10 or so of his books, 30 essays, poems, and even what we can find out by the underlinings in the books that he was reading right in his personal library, now held in the Marion Wade's collection in Wheaton College. On the phone with us today over in Seattle, Washington, is Dr. John West, the editor of the book. Dr. West, I'm going to call you the magician who has pulled the proverbial literary rabbit out of the hat through this incredible book. I was saying earlier to Bill, this is one of the bombshell books of the decade, in my view, in the area of apologetics related to C.S. Lewis. It must have been a lot of fun to put it together, although, of course, hard work.
It was, yeah. And especially finding new things that even I hadn't either remembered or didn't know about.
Yes. And many people do not realize how focused Lewis was on the problem of scientism. And before we delve into your essay, Darwin in the Dock, chapter 6 of this book, which to me is the powerful laser beam shooting out of the book right there in the middle, you can give us probably a good summary idea of what scientism is. You described that as a problem, and Lewis targeted it. What is scientism, and what does Lewis say about it?
You know, there are various definitions, but the one I think I'd gravitate toward is it's the idea that modern empirical science is really the only way to reach truth about the world. And then a natural corollary from that is modern science really should be used to dictate morality, deconstruct religion, and even guide social and governmental policy, or even dictate government and social policy, and even the idea that only people who are scientists, they should have the power to rule. So scientism in its narrower definition is it's the only way to know anything true, basically. But then the natural extension of that is, well, then that should rule society. And Lewis was definitely concerned about both scientism in the more narrow sense and scientism in the grander sense, which he really was writing against in novels like That Hideous Strength, Out of the Silent Planet, and also books like Miracles and The Abolition of Man.
Yes. And I'm so glad that you even singled out some of the most important essays that Lewis wrote, such as Bulverism.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, also the work that I am not very familiar with, it's the latter book that was published right at the end of his life.
Oh, yes, The Discarded Image.
The Discarded Image, which really is like a gold mine for his insights into this danger.
That was an eye-opener for me. You know, I had it on my shelf, and I had read it years ago, but in rereading it, technically, this was the last book he wrote. Mm-hmm. So these are his last thoughts, and it was published at the very end. And yet, it's supposed to be on the medieval worldview, which it is. But if you actually read it all the way through, especially to the ending epilogue, one of the big themes in the book is the nature of science and scientific revolutions. And he actually sort of predates Thomas Kuhn and on the structure of scientific revolutions about just how scientific revolutions can come about. And Lewis makes this particular application with regard to Darwinian biology, that it wasn't because of the evidence, in his view, that Darwinism triumphed. It was because people wanted to believe. And they had already been prepared by philosophers and materialists and others to want to believe in this scheme. And so they were ready when Darwin came. And as he said something very, very perceptive at the end, that nature answers the questions we ask her. And so his point is not that Darwinism, that everything people say in the name of it is false, but it's partial. And it's because, well, if you really think things are just the product of blind matter and motion, you're only going to ask certain questions of nature. And so you're going to get the answers to those questions. You're not going to ask other questions like, where did the information come from in the genes? And so, you know, Phil Johnson had a great book a few years ago called The Right Questions.
Yes.
And I found it just fascinating that Lewis raised the same point that Johnson did later, that when it comes to science, it's really critical of what questions you ask nature to begin with.
Exactly. On the phone with us today, the editor of the exciting, literally scintillating new book, The Magician's Twin, C.S. Lewis on Science, Scientism, and Society. And I wanted to point out here in your chapter 6, which is, again, it's the little bombshell within the bombshell book. It's really Darwin in the dock, really means Darwin on trial, correct? That's a kind of British terminology. And so Lewis, surprisingly, did put Darwin, at least the Darwinian mindless directed mechanism, on trial. He was open in principle to some, let's say, common ancestry notions. But what I found a little bit shocking is that those who would try to enlist C.S. Lewis in defense of theistic evolutionism have sometimes resorted to a little bit of shenanigans in even quoting Lewis. And I'm looking at this article published in the very prestigious, if among Christians working in science, a very prestigious journal, Perspectives on Science and Christian Faith, published by the American Scientific Affiliation. I have been a member in the past. I'm not right now. But Michael Peterson of Asbury Seminary said in his the article on Lewis as kind of a fellow theistic evolutionist, claiming him that way, he quotes Lewis in Mere Christianity as flatly affirming that, quote, everyone now knows, dot, 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 that man has evolved from lower types of life. And then you point out as if Lewis thought no reasonable person could disagree. I don't know if you have a copy of the book.
I do.
Okay, on page 112, tell us what our friend Peterson did.
So you quoted what he did, and here's the actual quote. Everyone now knows, and now here's what was cut out, about evolution. Though, of course, some educated people disbelieve it. Everyone has been told, now we go back to what Peterson quoted, that man has evolved from lower types of life. Peterson transformed something that had lots of caveats and was very carefully worded to something that was just a flat-out statement. And I have to say, in my days as a college professor, if I had caught an undergraduate doing that sort of manipulation for a quote, that would have been marked down heavily, if not failure. That is outrageous.
Right. And I think it's important that we let people be aware of this, that even in your follow-on essay, your chapter 7 in the book, which is specifically called C.S. Lewis and Intelligent Design, it's really tragic, I think. It's academic malfeasance, perhaps, but it's just simply tragic that Peterson doesn't even characterize intelligent design accurately. I think that's a fair statement. Would you agree?
Yes. And in fact, the most frustrating thing, Peterson's article claims to be much of it about Lewis and intelligent design, but if you actually read it, about 40% of it is about Peterson giving his own caricatured straw man view of intelligent design. If Peterson's view of intelligent design and his description were correct, I wouldn't even support it. Mm. Of course, C.S. Lewis wouldn't support that straw man version, but it's just, we've now had over 100 books written by alone of fellows of the Discovery Institute, let alone others like your wonderful books and things. And Peterson cites two books and miscites those. Mm. He doesn't even get those right. And so when he tries to claim there's this comprehensive view, in fact, in one really funny error, he cites in a footnote Steve Meyer's book, Signature in the Cell, but he attributes it to a David Myers. And so I don't know where he got that. In the online version by Biologos, they were smart enough to fix that. But in the Perspectives on Science and the Christian Faith, whatever vetting or peer review they did or didn't do, no one seemed to know. And so obviously he didn't even know what was in the book, let alone the author. I'm a bit shocked and dumbfounded by the quality of that essay. By Peterson. And again, this goes, unfortunately, among many people who call themselves theistic evolutionists, or I say theistic Darwinists, this is their level of discourse in supposedly refuting intelligent design. They set up a straw man version and then they knock that down. Mm. Well, that may make them feel good, but it really doesn't help get to the truth.
Right.
Now, I should say on Lewis, and I try to be careful because I'm not claiming that I would agree with absolutely everything Lewis did. I think, as I make clear in this chapter, there are really three kinds of evolution that Lewis addresses. One is evolution as common ancestry, one as Darwinian, unguided natural selection, and then the other is sort of as applied to society and social philosophy. And certainly, C.S. Lewis was much more open to common ancestry than I think the current evidence really substantiates. But it's interesting, even there, He basically would say what I would agree with, that I think in my own mind, Christians can accept common ancestry without doing violence to their faith. Now, there's a separate question about whether it's true or not. And there's also a question about what are the limits to it. And what's often not said, even people like Tim Keller, who are more thoughtful, who say, well, C.S. Lewis just embraced common ancestry, or in Keller's view, C.S. Lewis didn't believe in a historical Adam. And actually, if you delve down to Lewis, that's not true. Lewis had a much more limited view of common ancestry than some of these theistic evolutionists are saying.
We'll be right back with Dr. John West on The Universe Next Door after this quick break. Welcome back to The Universe Next Door, where today we are on the trail of an exciting story. The story is presented in a new volume entitled The Magician's Twin. It's subtitled C.S. Lewis on Science, Scientism, and Society. And this book is highly relevant to our ministry, the C.S. Lewis Society based in Tampa Bay, hosting, of course, the apologetics.org website, because we've been focusing for our entire history of 25 years on this topic as the center post of our discussion of evidence for God, evidence for at least intelligent design, and of course, combined with that, various other lines of historical and biblical evidence that you can employ to make a case for the Judeo-Christian faith, specifically for biblical faith. Now, as we're talking with today, Dr. John West, the editor and author of many sections of this book, but the editor of The Magician's Twin. Let's begin this segment, Dr. West, by reminding people that there was a book called The Magician's Nephew.
Yeah.
And that's sort of like Aslan creating the original world of Narnia from scratch. And then breathing in, or singing, I guess I could say, the beauty of creatures onto that planet, that world. So the magician's nephew, of course, is in the mind of many Narnia lovers already. Explain what Magician's Twin is. I think that's really key to understanding why you chose that title.
Well, you know, there is a connection between the magician's nephew, but the most direct connection is with something Lewis wrote in his book, The Abolition of Man, where he has this fascinating little paragraph where he basically says that modern science and magic, as in, you know, magic during the Middle Ages and things, were twins. And this might seem really outlandish to people. What does magic, deals with superstition, magic deals with, you know, hocus pocus. What does that have to do with hard, rational science? And so that, I think, is a very intriguing comparison. And so part of this, the function of this book is to tease that out. And really, just in a very, you know, quick summary of it, I think Lewis thought that how science could function like a religion. He also saw how science could lead people to be gullible in a strange sort of way, and we can unpack that if you want. And then finally, he thought science and magic were similar because they both could have this quest for power over the world. And of course, that can be good. You know, a lot of scientific things, I love a lot of things in modern science. If I hadn't had my word processor and my Mac computer, I couldn't have written this book in as expeditious a way. And so, you know, that power can be good, but of course, as the old saying from Lord Acton, you know, power tends to corrupt. And so there is danger there too. And so science as just power to remake the world, to play God, if you will, was a real danger. And that does give a tie-in then to the magician's twin, because the witch there, or the empress, Jadis, who at the end really believes in magic as this absolute power over the world. And in fact, there's a little interesting dialogue near the end of the book where it's very clear that Lewis is pointing towards not just magic, but science. And in fact, the magician in the book, or the title, is the uncle. And it's described that he's a magician, but he also does experiments. And I think he has a microscope. And so he's a magician and a scientist. So this theme actually runs throughout that was sketched out in The Abolition of Man. You find it in his, you know, Narnia Chronicles, and you find it in some other places too.
Very good. So there's a parallelism. There's a relationship between these two twins, the twin that didn't make it into modern day,
yes,
at least as a respectable thing to study in the university, maybe at Hogwarts,
yes, <that's
laughs> something right. Like, you know, the Harry Potter movies. So the parallelism, I think you were just ticking off the three points, science, like the old defunct magic of, you know, branch of study from the Middle Ages could be seen as leading into sort of a religion, science and magic, religious entities at times. They both have kind of a credulity that they can usher in within certain sectors of humanity, and both of them seek to have power over nature. Very interesting parallelism. What, Dr. West, do you see as one or two of the points where Lewis, if he were alive today, just based on his writings, would be supportive of the program and some of the conclusions or assumptions of intelligent design?
Oh, yeah, that's a fascinating question. Lewis, when he lost his faith, one of the things that really was powerful to him was what he called the argument from undesign. Pain, suffering, things breaking down, not working. And so when he became a Christian and when he became a theist, he had to work through that. And I think he really came to appreciate some of the insights of a world of design. And so one of the things that really fascinated me that is probably most directly related to intelligent design is an insight he got from Boethius and other medieval philosophers that really comes from Plato, the idea that you can't, an effect cannot be greater than its cause. And so this unguided evolutionism, as he called it, the thinking that you could have rude and crude and simple things and suddenly become conscious and suddenly have morality and suddenly become much more complicated and intricate and functional, from when the things that preceded them were supposed to be just blind matter in motion, that violates this fundamental insight that the medievals had and that all rational people could have, that an effect cannot be greater than its underlying cause. And if you really take that seriously, then you need to think that to explain things, especially like human beings, you have to have a cause that is at least as rational as the human beings it's producing. It can't be something less. And he wrote on this in some of his essays and actually in a lecture he gave to the Socratic Club at Oxford in the 1940s. And it's a very, really has a lot of synergy with intelligent design type of reasoning.
And in your book, the book that you edited, The Magician's Twin, that we're featuring today, there's a lot of discussion of reasoning itself, the reasoning power of mankind, as not fully explicable, not really plausibly explicable at all, from blind Darwinian unintelligent process. If you could just feature the importance of that issue.
Yes.
And even maybe a bit about the work of your special invited author who dealt with a dangerous idea.
Oh, yes. Victor Ruppert, author of C.S. Lewis's Dangerous Idea, and also Jay Richards, who also had a chapter on that. Well, you know, Lewis's basic point was that you can't get mind from a mindless process. And again, it's part of this larger argument that you can't get an effect that's greater than its initial cause. And so that featured prominently in his book, Miracles, but also in essays that you had previously referenced, like Bulverism. And so it was really key to his argument. It was also what many people don't realize, because, and this was also a difference I have with Michael Peterson. Peterson will grant, well, yeah, Lewis was against mindless reductionism. But what Peterson doesn't know is that in Miracles, when Lewis is attacking this sort of the idea that you can get mind from a mindless process, his stand-in for materialism is Darwinian natural selection. He actually gives an account of, you know, well, here's what the materialists say, that natural selection just targeted survival, enhancing instincts, and that somehow brought around, consciousness and reason. And Lewis is actually skewering not just materialism in general, but the Darwinian claim that you could get mind through an unguided process of natural selection.
This is such an important volume. I really believe that we need to, feature a second program. And I've actually talked to Dr. Victor Ruppert about coming on the program.
Oh, great.
And he has agreed to. He's just a wonderful guy. And we want to feature, of course, his full-length book on the topic. But in this particular book, The Magician's Twin, we actually have a kind of a cool summary, a very helpful summary of that book and an extension of the argument into this area a bit more. Lewis actually was reading as a non-Christian student at Oxford something that was being written at that time, this emergent evolution idea from Henri Bergson. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. But in this study of the emergent evolutionism concept, Lewis realizes early on the problems with Darwinian natural selection. Would you agree in about 20 seconds or so?
Yes, and the Bergson, it was like a detective story peeling back this influence on Lewis, which actually was even earlier. It was right when he was a World War I soldier recovering from his wounds. It's a fascinating story.
Okay. Well, maybe we can get a little bit more of that story of Lewis picking up some of the threads of skepticism about this power of natural selection, even before he ever thought about becoming a follower of Christ and literally became a Christian in 1931. Today, we are featuring very prominently the most important book we've talked about in some time called The Magician's Twin. It is Lewis's take on science and the problem of scientism, the idea that only science is a reliable source of knowledge in the modern world and therefore can be only taken seriously by government entities as they engineer the future. We have with us on the phone Dr. John West. He is the editor of this book and has written three fantastic articles. The highlights of the book will be extending into the further sections of the book in the next segment. Please stay with us here on The Universe Next Door. Welcome back to our special program on The Magician's Twin, a powerful new book just released by the Discovery Institute. It is available everywhere on the internet, and of course, it's available on our own web store at apologetics.org. Just click on the top page where it says store, and it will lead you right into the spot where you can order the book. It's a very valuable volume for really delving into the views of C.S. Lewis expressed in many of his books. There are so many of his books and essays where he tried to analyze the problems of science run amok. You might say science going beyond its natural and proper God-given functions and trying to take the function rather of a religion or of an all-powerful, all-determining source of knowledge of which there is only one, namely science. We call that scientism, and the views of modern scientists sometimes verge into that area, that philosophical distortion of science that we call scientism. And the best source of understanding Lewis's critique of that is The Magician's Twin. Again, the authors are various powerful modern-day scholars, and one of them is with us. He's the editor, Dr. John West. And Dr. West, you have also produced a powerful book on Darwin Day, I believe. Is it in America?
Yep, Darwin Day in America, which really is the impact of social Darwinism on culture, education, economics, business over the past century and a half.
It's one of the most important books on Darwinism that I've ever read, and I commend you for all of your research, but especially these two books, Darwin Day in America, and of course the current book that we're looking at today, The Magician's Twin. As you were pulling this together, your team was able to produce at least one and maybe even several DVD or documentary video efforts. Could you tell us a little bit about those productions?
Oh, yeah, this is exciting. So we're going to be releasing over the next year three different videos inspired by this book. The first one is going to come out on YouTube and possibly on a cable channel in November, which is the anniversary of both Lewis's birth and death. And it's called The Magician's Twin, C.S. Lewis on Scientism in Society. The next two videos will focus specifically on Lewis and Darwin and Lewis and Intelligent Design. But this first one really summarizes his case against scientism, and it's about a half hour long. We've been screening it in a few places around the country preparatory to being released on YouTube and on this cable channel and satellite channel in November.
That's exciting. We would like to be involved in that in whatever way we can, for sure, in promoting it here in the Tampa Bay area and also other parts of the country where our program is heard. We are excited to be able to kind of feature this special topic because the C.S. Lewis Society was launched on the Princeton University campus by young scholars who were concerned about the skeptical slant of their own campus, the university campus in the Princeton area of New Jersey, had been known for many, many years as a Christian or Judeo-Christian institution of learning. And of course, it veered starting in the 1800s, but especially later picking up speed in the 1900s toward a more secular view of learning. And I have actually done a lot of research on the Princeton campus and its turn toward evolutionary teaching. Many, many people are unaware of the fact that there are a number of Christian scholars on that campus in the sciences, in the engineering departments, who actually hold a view which is consistent with intelligent design and believe that the unguided forces of nature cannot produce the complex structures we see in living cells today. Among them, of course, our own friend and often interviewee of this program, Dr. Robert Kaida of the Plasma Physics Department, a wonderful scholar in the area of physics and, of course, a great articulator of his faith in Christ as creator and redeemer. Our guest today again, Dr. John West, you have been helping us to understand Lewis's take on science and society. Tell us in a little bit of a nutshell overview what his book, That Hideous Strength, brings to the table on this topic.
That Hideous Strength really shows what happens when this view that could be called scientific materialism, the idea that modern science can justify a materialist worldview, gets to be the view that government is based on and academia is based on and is then used to remake and refashion all of society. And interestingly, in that book, you know, things start off by invoking reason and science, but Lewis shows that really, if you adopt that sort of materialist worldview, even though you may justify it by science, by the end of the book, you're really seeing superstition and a willingness to believe almost anything. And so it shows how dehumanizing it can be. For example, and this is very topical for his time, like eugenics, the effort to breed a better human race, the effort to get rid of punishment and turn punishment into treatment of criminals that could be very coercive and dehumanizing, moral relativism, this sort of elitism that ends up really undermining freedom and personal freedoms. And so this is, it's a really frightening novel. And what's interesting is it is so topical now. And in fact, one of the things, we have a chapter in the book by a professor from Hope College, James Herrick, on the transhumanist movement, which really is the latter day view right now of many intellectuals that we should re-engineer human beings for a new stage of evolution. And just actually, earlier this year, one of these scholars who's actually at C.S. Lewis's old Oxford University, his name is Julian Savulescu, was in the news for basically saying we should breed moral individuals. And he's not talking about training people, but breed genetically, you know, enhanced people. And actually, Oxford University, Lewis's old stomping grounds, is a hotbed of this transhumanist movement, with multiple professors urging us to do aggressive genetic engineering to re-engineer human beings.
On the phone with us today, Dr. John West, commenting on Lewis's novel, That Hideous Strength. Dr. West, I've actually used illustrations from that book in my own teaching on Lewis to show his fear, his a warning, I guess you could say, about viewing science as this all-powerful source of wisdom in every area. And would you say that we actually have seen the examples that you mentioned, for example, in chapter one, as a bit, would you agree that they're a bit alarming when we see, for example, Lovelock? I think you brought out his suggestion that it may be necessary on page 37. You say British scientist James Lovelock has called for the suspension of democracy if it's needed in the name of saving the planet from global warming. I was shocked to read that. Would you agree that what Lewis foresaw in that book is really, in some cases, coming down the road at us?
Yes, I mean, it is coming down the road, and it's already here in some cases. And in a more sort of humorous, but also a little bit disturbing example is, you know, you have this whole thing of banning soft drinks in New York that are, you know, have sugar, which I don't tend to drink soft drinks, and so I think I agree with that on health-wise. I don't agree that the government should be banning sugar drinks and stuff. But we have an evolutionary biologist at Harvard, Daniel Lieberman, who actually wrote an op-ed justifying that, saying we have evolved, evolution has made us so we need coercion. And so the reason why the government now has to regulate our diet and ban what sort of soft drinks we can buy is because evolution has, you know, made us that we need this sort of coercion. So it's hard to lampoon some of this stuff because the lampooning turned out to be true. People are actually advocating things.
Yes. And of course, another thing you brought out, when the Obama administration mandated that many private religious employers include contraceptives and even certain kinds of abortion drugs, the key justification was brought out by Secretary of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Sebelius, saying, quote, scientists have abundant evidence that birth control has significant health benefits for women, on page 37 of your book. And I thought this is really, you know, an example of scientism starting to rear its head in our society. And I wanted to just let you bring in a very encouraging thing that we can do. You brought out that there was even a sense of action, a point of action for the ordinary man. Your book I found very encouraging over and over, that we can, ordinary Christians, ordinary, let's say even people who love the Tao, who love absolute morality, objective morality, can do something. What is that we can do collectively, at least begin to do?
Well, you know, I always think that the first solution for anything is to begin to proclaim the truth. And so I think that really being honest about the limits of science, being willing to make, you know, puncture these people, you know, the rhetorical bluster that says, well, science says it, I believe it, therefore we need to do it. Many times, of course, science is a good thing, but you have people who are twisting science and claiming to be infallible, which is certainly not true. And so I think this promotion of genuine critique and discussion and being willing to say it's not enough if someone drapes themselves in science and to say that therefore we have the right to rule, that's not true. And they have to justify themselves. And we have the right in a democratic and representative democracy to really raise real objections and to not just let a few unelected experts to command us. I think, you know, that sort of pushback is really helpful.
And I think that's a very good point. Even at the end of The Magician's Nephew, the book, believe it's the young fellow, is it Diggory?
Yeah.
Who is enticed by the wicked witch, Jadis, to misuse the powers of the special apple from that one-of-a-kind apple tree that can actually bring health. And what does Diggory do? Just go ahead, if you could give the punchline.
Oh, sure. And he decides not to do it. Mm-hmm. And it, because of that, he basically helps protect Narnia for many years to come. Now, again, we live in a sinful world, and so it doesn't provide absolute protection, but by making the right choices of not going down the path of scientism and just doing it because some people are claiming the name of science, we actually can start to bring wholeness and protection to our culture.
And I like to say to students who are studying with me for philosophy that even when someone like A.J. Ayer, the logical positivist version, you know, who propounded his own version of scientism, when he said, you know, if something is not verified by the five senses, it's worse than false, it's meaningless. And I have my students understand that, what's the problem with that statement? That statement itself cannot be verified by the five senses. It refutes itself, as so much of scientism does. Thank you so much for joining us, Dr. West, and we wish you well in the proclamation of this great bit of a re-education of all of us, or at least further education through the magician's twin. We take our hats off to you.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. And thank you for listening this week, as always, to The Universe Next Door. I'm Tom Woodward. We'll see you back here next week.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2014. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.